Hello and welcome. This is 42 Minutes, a production of Syncbook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. I am Douglas Bowles, and today we are bringing you a special bonus edition of the program. Happy Thanksgiving, or No Thanksgiving. Today we have the pleasure of meeting Jacqueline Keeler, writer and producer. I first encountered her work in the pages of Parabola magazine, but she also has written for Winds of Change and an American Indian journal. Her writings on American identity and politics can be found at her blog, tospaynow.blogspot.com. You can also find her Twitter at jfkeeler. Today we will consider Thanksgiving from a Native point of view. Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, hello.
Before we really begin, I see that your Twitter says that you're finishing your first novel. May we ask how it's going and what it's about?
It's going pretty well. I mean, I finished the final draft. I'm just making a few changes. I wrote a second novel as well, which I finished the first draft of. But this novel I'm finishing is called Leaving the Glittering World. It's sort of like a lot of first novels. It's a coming-of-age story, and it's set where I grew up, at Hanford, which is a nuclear reservation, where they basically refine the first plutonium to be used in the atomic bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki.
Wow.
Yeah. My dad was an engineer, so like a lot of American Indians, you know, math and science is easier than things having to do with English, because of course math and science are universal languages. And so, so he went into engineering. And so that's how we ended up living there. He had to engineer little boxes where atoms were exactly speeded up to a certain level and to certain tensions. And for me, it was very significant growing up there because it was a completely government town. It was a national laboratory. And everyone worked for the government, and everything was top secret. And
everything was radioactive.
Everything was radioactive. Yeah. And my grandfather, my Navajo grandfather, had actually been a uranium miner. And there were still open uranium mines on my mom's family's ranch near the south rim of the Grand Canyon when I was growing up. They buried them finally just recently. So for me, there was a whole history having to do with nuclear atomic issues. And I was really inspired by a poem by Leslie Mormon Silco, the Laguna Acoma Pueblo writer, and her poem about the creation of the atomic bomb being an act of witchcraft. So I started from there. And it takes place during when they discovered the Kendrick Man skeleton there, the 10,000-year-old skeleton.
No, I was as when you said you were from Hanford, all of a sudden I was connecting a lot of different things, and I thought, isn't there there's a whole bit of dispute around the Kennewick Man too.
It's actually my sister's friend who found the skeleton. They were trying to sneak into a boat race, one of those hydroplane races they have on the Columbia River there, and they found the skeleton was exposed, and they found it. And actually, someone I grew up knowing, he was an anthropologist, was the first person to look at the skeleton. He was actually very well regarded by the local Indian people there, the Wampanoag Indians near Hanford. They're right there at Coos Rapids Dam. Their village is very interesting. They followed a visionary named Smohalla, who started his own religion, and basically they refused to sign a treaty. So now they have this little village that's stuck between a missile testing site behind them and then Hanford on the other side of the river. And then a dam they have to go across to get to their village. And but my dad's family, my grandmother's cousin includes Vine Deloria Jr., who's a very well-known Native scholar. He wrote Custer Died for Your Sins and We Speak, You Listen, On the Trail of Broken Trees, and God is Red. And so he was a major voice for the American Indian movement in the 60s and 70s. But he actually did a debate with poor Jim Chatters, the anthropologist we knew, and tore him apart. But yeah, it was a very contentious issue. The tribes wanted a skeleton reburied because they view him as an ancestor. And the scientists wanted to study the DNA because it's a very rare occurrence to find a complete skeleton of that age. It was dated at 10,000 years old. And it was very interesting to me because growing up there was no sense that Indians had lived there before, really. Actually, I remember my dad getting a videotape to when we were trying to recruit him to come out there. And it said like that no Indians would live there because there was, the area was so inundated with mosquitoes and malaria and stuff. And so there was this whole thing where like it was sort of the Indian history had been erased. And then it wasn't until later that I found out that there was there near where he was found an ancient village that had been occupied for 15,000 years, right there at the mouth of the Yakima River where it empties into the Columbia. And it was interesting to me because when I was growing up, we used to do shows out there. It was during the whole grunge movement, and people used to come out there and play music and do things. And it was interesting to think that there was an ancient village beneath us, and no one told us. But we were naturally drawn to the space to share and create our own culture as young people.
Huh.
So that's what the novel sort of is. It's sort of a juxtaposition between all that.
And does it have a nuclear heart?
Well, yeah, I think leaving the Glittering World, the Glittering World is a Navajo. My mother is Navajo, and my father is Yankton Dakota Sioux. So they're two different tribes. And they have two very different religions. I mean, spiritual, their ideas are very different about the world. So in the Navajo way, we emerged into this world from the fourth. This is the fourth world. So we emerged from a previous world, and it was being flooded, and we escaped. And we kind of, it's like a birth imagery. We emerged from a reed, and the water was bubbling up, you know, sort of like a child being born into the world. And what happened was that Coyote had stolen the water baby from the water monster. And so they saw after they had emerged into this world that he had this water baby. So they returned it back to the water monster from the previous world. So my idea is that the scientists who unleashed the first atomic bomb were like Coyote stealing the water baby. And so that basically then this world we've emerged into is a completely new world. It's like the fifth world and this post-atomic age, and that we need new songs. Because in the Navajo, after they emerged into this world, the Ye'i, the gods of this world, came to them and gave them corn to, you know, to live with, to eat. It's like our sacred, it's like wheat is in Europe and the Middle East. Corn here in the Americas is our sacred food. And we pray with the pollen and the cornmeal. And then they also gave them songs to heal, just to heal themselves with. I know the Navajos are famous for their like 9-day ceremonies where they sing. Our medicine men are called singers, Hatatli. And so they sing these songs and they sing you back into health. And sometimes they go all night and all day for 9 days. They have like enemy way ceremonies. And they do these really intricate sand paintings. And the sand paintings are very specific. If you do them wrong, you could hurt someone. And so it's similar to the scientist's equations. So I sort of draw a correlation between the two. In my mind, there is. So
as kind of a funny aside, I think my own identity, I was prompted partially by the Navajo way to find... This is what's interesting about if you're the dominant culture, then pop culture is your culture.
Uh-huh.
But it's so ubiquitous, you don't necessarily feel like you have a tribe, even though your tribe is the tribe.
Yeah.
And so when I was in my 20s, I read a ton of Tony Hillerman books.
Oh, yeah.
And they're fun, but they got me thinking about mythology and... And, you know, so if I were to find, you know, who, like, what is my mythology? If I go back to my tribe, to its roots, to find, you know, where am I, you know, who are my people? What's my core? And eventually my journey took me, to the pagan forests of Germany. And then we got, you know, the whole Norse pantheon. And that's lots of fun, too. But so in the process, I ended up learning quite a bit about the Navajo way, and one of the things that I really like is their idea of balance, or is it Hojo?
Hojo.
Yeah.
Hojo.
And so
yeah.
How they encode the universe kind of in, and do you say it Hogan or Hogan?
Hogan, yeah, a Navajo house.
Yeah, and so inside when they're doing the sand painting, they're creating, you know, harmony, and then they actually take the person and put them in the painting. And so it's like this macrocosm and microcosm where you have the smaller universe and the larger universe, and they're trying to put the individual back into balance with nature.
You know, my grandfather was a traditional Navajo man. He didn't speak English. You know, he was raised... The Navajo Nation is very large. It's the size of Ireland. and or West Virginia is usually what it's compared to. And then, and population-wise, the last census put it at like 308,000 people. So it's about the same population as like Iceland, and just as remote in some ways. And so they are amongst, and they're mostly full-bloods who speak their language. So it's an unusual, it's like a nation within a nation. And when you go to the Navajo Nation, people speak Navajo. You turn the radio on, and it's in Navajo. You know, and so it's so my grandparents, their generation that came of age in the 1930s and 40s, they were, most of them had not gone to school. They were completely traditional. And my mother was the first generation to go to school. Luckily, by the time my grandparents were hidden. They were tried to go and steal children and take them off to Indian boarding schools where they had pretty terrible experiences, you know, child molestation. That's why a lot of Indian families are deeply scarred from those experiences. So we were lucky. We escaped that. My mom didn't go to school until they had a public school there in Tuba City. So she was able to live with her family and then go to a school where the majority of the people were Navajo, 90% of the students were Navajo. And so I think they gave her a different perspective on the world being, really growing up in an environment where her tribe was the dominant society. She didn't leave that till she went to college, and it was quite a shock for her, you know. So in three generations, my family has really changed quite a bit, you know. A lot of my cousins still live on the reservation and speak Navajo, but my line, my dad is from a different tribe. And so, you know, so it's a blending of things, and there are certain things that are lost as well, which are painful to me, but I really, you know,
so
really
then
wonderful.
Do you really feel divided? I mean, so that's so fascinating because...
Well, I couldn't speak to my grandparents, you know, I mean, because they spoke a different language and they didn't speak English. I mean, very, very, you know, they could say things like, can I go to the restroom? Things that a lot of people, tourists, can say when they go to other countries. But yeah, I think I that's part of writing for me. That's part of blending those things together in a way that's workable for me. And that's why I write. And I do that for my children and my nieces and nephews. I want to build a space for them to be in this world because they are now, with my nephews and nieces, they are two generations removed from the reservation. And, you know, and I don't know if any of them are ever going to go back, you know. I mean, people marry other Indian people from other tribes, but they all... I mean, 70% of all Indians live off the reservation. They live in urban areas. So when you're talking about the reservation population, you're talking about a minority of Indian people in the country. And so yeah, this is, I think that I didn't have many books, many novels to use as a pattern. I mean, I really had to turn to writings by other groups. You know, I would say second generation immigrants, American immigrants, like Jewish American writers. I had to look at their work. I had to look at colonial writers like Zadie Smith, to get a sense of how to write this novel, because so many novels are written from the perspective of someone raised on the reservation who then has issues with white culture. I was raised, you know, in basically a suburban community where my sisters and I were often the only Indians in the school. And that is much more typical of the Indian experience than you would think. So I'm actually writing for the majority of Indians, actually. And their story has not been told. And
that's wonderful. You say, you mentioned earlier about creating a sacred space for your kids. Could you elaborate then on the name of your blog?
Oh, Teoshpaya Now. Teoshpaya. I have a great-great aunt. Her name is Ella Deloria. And the Deloria family in South Dakota is very well known for all the work they've done in the community and in writing. And she graduated from Columbia University in 1915, from Columbia Teachers College. And she started working with Franz Boas, who was the founder of American Anthropology. And she could speak all three dialects of the Dakota, Lakota, Nakota language. And she traveled around and interviewed a lot of elders who had been alive before the reservation years. And my grandmother, later in the 30s, traveled with her and acted as her secretary. And there's many books she's written, like Water Lily, Speaking of Indians, and many unpublished manuscripts, which I read when I went to South Dakota at the Dakota Indian Foundation. So one of the things that she really focuses on is the Teoshpaya, which is it's the group of teepees, a circle of teepees where a family would live, an extended family, not just an immediate family, but an extended family. And she describes in detail how the kinship system works, how they valued each other and how they worked together. And it's an amazing, I mean, really reading Water Lily was an amazing experience for me. I cried because it's a sense of what we lost, you know, I mean, that could have, you just really sense the depth of what was lost. I think that a lot of it was just destroyed without ever being looked at, you know, these societies, these whole cultures. And so I felt very, very lucky to have that in my family with, you know, people who were able to take the time to write these things down and to interview people. She wrote it not only in the dialect, but also in direct English translations, and then translations that she felt contained more of the actual meaning of what they were saying. So Teoshpaya now, when I title my blog, but I'm saying that I want that kinship back. I want that back in our communities. I want that back for my children to be part of a larger sort of Teoshpaya and that circle of teepees again. And so that's something that I'm talking about. And I think, you know, my husband and I, when we were first married, we did the Sundance. And we did it actually on Navajo land. My grandma's cousins live at Big Mountain, Black Mesa, where they're fighting removal because they're strip mining the land for coal. And so I went out there and they do a Sundance. They actually went to South Dakota with a pipe and they asked for some Lakota medicine man and his family to come and bring the ceremony to them. And so it was an interesting blending of both my cultures, you know, of my dad's tribe and my mother's tribe. And so that's where I Sundanced. And my grandparents, my Navajo grandparents, were very disapproving because that's not their tradition. You know, you don't cut yourself. They call in Navajo, they call it the ceremony where they rip their flesh out. And so they don't approve of the Sundance because it's Navajo ways are different than Sioux ways. They're just different, you know. So sometimes fundamentally different. It's a taboo. You would never cut yourself in the Navajo way. You never cut your flesh out. But in the Dakota way, that's one of our most sacred ceremonies. Huh. So I sort of combined them by doing the ceremony there. And I Sundance for the other people. You know, you dance for 4 days and looking at the sun, praying without food or water. And they put up a sacred tree in the middle of the arbor, and you put your prayers on that tree. And the men would hang from the tree. My husband has scars on his chest where he hung from the tree, you know, and pulled free. And that was an incredibly meaningful experience to me to do that. I really understood and lived for a while that culture that my great aunt described. But it also, there were things that were missing. I felt like a lot of the people participating didn't understand the culture it came from. They had no clue. And that was very disappointing. And that's another reason I say Teoshpaya now, because we're reenacting these ceremonies, but we don't know even the culture they came from. Instead, a lot of these men particularly have this very boarding school mentality that sort of, you know, where they beat up on the little people that was sort of taught to them. Some of them are coming out of the prison system, so they have very ways that are completely in opposition to our traditions. And so it's sort of disappointing. I would really like to see more Indian people read my great aunt's work and really understand in a very fundamental way how our cultures were structured and how they were very, very different.
Well, remind us, what is her name?
Oh, Ella Deloria.
And you think we should start with Water Lily?
Yeah, Water Lily is good. Speaking of Indians is good. Water Lily is an ethnographic novel she wrote that in which she packed in all her knowledge of how Dakota culture worked before the white people came. And so you can see there.
It's interesting. It seems like a lot of people are trying to run this equation, how to get back to a sustainable world. And it seems like this is one of those directions, you know.
Well, I think that's the really amazing thing about when these cultures met, the cultures coming from Europe, the people from Europe and the people here in the Americas, is there was such an exchange of ideas that happened. And that really fundamentally changed the world. You know, I think some of my other pieces cover like what happened, you know, with, of course, a lot of people are familiar with the Iroquois and their influence on the creation of the Constitution of the United States. the colonists came up with the Tidaho, the leader of the Iroquois Confederacy, actually went around the colonies and gave speeches telling the colonists that they should unite. And that famous thing where they put the arrows together and showed them that arrows together are stronger than individual arrows, that's a traditional Iroquois thing. And so he went around and gave a speech, and Benjamin Franklin actually published that speech. He translated it from Mohawk into English. He could speak Mohawk. A lot of colonists had a lot more contact with the tribes through trading and employment than people realize. And that's how he made his first fortune. That was his first successful publication. And so a lot of these founding fathers grew up reading the Tidaho's words. And this is where a lot of the ideas about the, how, I think, you know, they got the ideas from ancient Rome, but what's much more influential in making you decide to try something is things you see every day that are actually living cultures. You see people living in a democratic structure and you think, well, they can have that, why can't I? You know, and the same thing happened with women's rights. You know, the Seneca women lived in a village adjacent to the women of Seneca, the white women of Seneca Falls. And the women of Seneca Falls, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they saw how different the lives of the Iroquois women were. They saw that they had rights that they did not possess. Because in the way the Iroquois Confederacy is structured, the women have choose the leadership. The clan mothers have final say. They can remove male leaders when they want to. All the property is owned to the women. A lot of Native cultures are matrilineal. They're property and inheritance rights are all traced through the mother, her family. It's just, my husband is Iroquois, and I'm Navajo, and it's that way in both our tribes. So that had a huge influence. And when you read Elizabeth Cady Stanton's speeches at Seneca Falls, she says, I want what I see Seneca women have every single day. I want that for me. You know, and so you have to realize the huge influence that living American Indian cultures had on the colonists, and then how that then spread across the world. I mean, how many millions of women have been freed by that observation? How many millions of women's lives have been fundamentally changed? Probably billions.
Are you familiar with Joseph Campbell?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And so one of the things that he would always stress is that for a mythology to be complete, that it needed to have four functions: the mystical function, the cosmological function, the sociological function, and a pedagogical function. And so the mystical function communicates the reverence for the mystery of life. The cosmological kind of is the story of how and why and where it's going. The sociological function defines the people and their place. And then the pedagogical shows an individual in the community how one is to live, the stages of life, how's one to live. And so with this in mind, could you tell us the Thanksgiving myth that children are taught?
Okay. You know, it's interesting because I'm writing an article right now, not an op-ed, about the Washington Redskins. It's a big issue in the country right now. And it's something that's very not a great thing to look at, because you read the comment sections and it's all like, you know, it's just immediately goes from like, we want to honor Indians to like, Indians are drunk and stupid and they should go away, you know? And so the depth of their honoring is not very deep. And so, but yeah, I think, you know, of course I was taught that. I mean, I went to a pretty much all white elementary school. And but I, you know, I think that there was more of an attempt when I was a child to try to listen to all sides. I think that people were making an effort back then. I think, I guess the image is that there were points where people met together in a peaceful way.
Well, so I found you by your Thanksgiving essay. Have you ever done a dramatic reading of your own work?
Well,
would you
know,
like to read?
I actually did a version for Pacifica, for KPSA in Berkeley. And,
oh, you did?
Yeah, it was years ago, and they made me shorten it even more and stuff. Yeah, I could read it if you want me to.
Yeah, I think that would... I think our listeners would definitely appreciate that. Give it a shot.
Okay. So, I celebrate the holiday of Thanksgiving. This may surprise those people who wonder what Native Americans think of this official U.S. celebration of the survival of early arrivals in a European invasion that culminated in the death of 10 to 30 million Native people. Thanksgiving to me has never been about pilgrims. When I was six, my mother, a woman of the Dene Nation, told my sister and me not to sing Land of the Pilgrims Pride in America the Beautiful. Our people, she said, had been here much longer and taken much better care of the world. We were to sing Land of the Indians Pride instead. I was proud to sing the new lyrics in school, but I sang softly. It was enough for me to know the difference. At six, I felt I had learned something very important. As a child of a Native American family, you are part of a very select group of survivors. And I learned that my family possessed some inside knowledge of what really happened when those poor, tired masses came to our homes. When the pilgrims came to Plymouth Rock, they were poor and hungry. Half of them died within a few months from disease and hunger. When Squanto, a Wampanoag man, found them, they were in a pitiful state. He spoke English, having traveled to Europe, and took pity on them. Their English crops had failed. The native people fed them through the winter and taught them how to grow their food. These were not merely friendly Indians. They had already experienced European slave traders raiding their villages for 100 years or so, and they were wary, but it was their way to give freely to those who had nothing. Among many of our peoples, showing that you can give without holding back is the way to earn respect. Among the Dakota, my father's people, they say when asked to give, "Are we not Dakota and alive?" It was believed that by giving, there would be enough for all. The exact opposite of the system we live in now, which is based on selling, not giving. To the pilgrims and most English and European peoples, the Wampanoags were heathens and the devil, and of the devil. They saw Squanto not as an equal, but as an instrument of their God to help his chosen people, themselves. Since that initial sharing, Native American food has spread around the world. Nearly 70% of all crops grown today were originally cultivated by Native American peoples. I sometimes wonder what they ate in Europe before they met us. Spaghetti without tomatoes, meat and potatoes without potatoes. And at the first Thanksgiving, the Wampanoags provided most of the food and signed a treaty granting the pilgrims the right to land at Plymouth. The real reason for the first Thanksgiving. What did the Europeans give in return? Within 20 years, European diseases and treachery had decimated the Wampanoags. Most diseases then came from animals that Europeans had domesticated. Cowpox from cows led to smallpox, one of the great killers of our people, spread through gifts of blankets used by infected Europeans. Some estimate that diseases accounted for a death toll reaching 90% in some Native American communities. By 1623, Mather the Elder, a pilgrim leader, was giving thanks to his God for destroying the heathen savages to make way for a better growth, meaning his people. In stories told by the Dakota people, an evil person always keeps his or her heart in a secret place separate from the body. The hero must find that secret place and destroy the heart in order to stop the evil. I see in the first Thanksgiving story a hidden pilgrim heart. The story of that heart is the real tale that needs to be told. What did it hold? Bigotry, hatred, greed, self-righteousness. We have seen the evil that it caused in the 350 years since. Genocide, environmental devastation, poverty, world wars, racism. Where is the hero who will destroy the heart of evil? I believe it must be each of us. Indeed, when I give thanks this Thursday and I cook my native food, I will be thinking of this hidden heart and how my ancestors survived the evil it caused. Because if we can survive with our ability to share and to give intact, then the evil and the good that met that Thanksgiving day in the land of the Wampanoag will have come full circle, and the healing can begin.
Thank you. That's very powerful. When did you write this?
I wrote it back in, actually I wrote it quite a while ago, 1998.
Wow.
And it was first published in the San Francisco Examiner. And so I was writing under a lot of pressure from my editor. and I kept calling me all day. And actually when I sat down to write it, I really was writing it for my children. And at the time I didn't have children. But I wrote it as if I were talking to them.
Well, you probably have never heard this, but are you familiar with The Shining?
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's Stanley Kubrick, and so everyone has a theory what he was trying to really say.
I've heard this. Yes, I've heard this.
I wonder. I mean, so it's just so fascinating that maybe the secret heart that you speak of is, you know, what drives Jack mad and why he kills his family. You know, what do you think of that?
Possibly. I really was, after I heard that, I was really fascinated by that because, you know, that movie, I was always afraid to see it. And when I finally saw it, it was pretty scary for me. But I really, you know, it was certain scenes that really stay with you. And yeah, I could see that. I could definitely see that. You know, I think when I was writing this, I was thinking a lot of my Aunt Ella's work because I had just finished college and I had done a lot of my senior thesis had been on her work. And, you know, a lot of the stories I reference in here come from her and those stories that she wrote down. I think that knowing those stories really gives me strength, you know, because it gives me another lens to see the world through and to understand it and to make sense of it. You know,
what about hope?
I really, you know, I'm an optimist, and it's sad. I'm so optimistic, and I know that that's probably not realistic, but I can't stop being that way. It's just who I am, and I can't stop working for something, a better understanding between people. I truly believe that all people, all nations have really amazing things to share. I mean, what I would just like to see are all people bringing that to the table, you know, and putting the other stuff aside. You know, I think, and really, you know, it's sort of like with science where you have peer review. And, you know, maybe we need to peer review our ideas, our prejudices to test, you know. we probably need that kind of process to correct our more, ridiculous tendencies as human beings.
Sure,
know?
Like our American cultural myths. Some of these things, do you see them evolving and becoming more progressive, or are they still kind of defining?
Well, I still see Native Americans as being incredibly marginalized in the American consciousness. I still see them as occupying a very small space, and mostly in the past. I don't see modern Indian people very well represented. I know everyone complains about the quota system, but, you know, if you think about TV and think about, like, well, what if every character in TV was sort of like by the quota system, like 1 in 10 characters were black, like main characters. What if, you know, 1 in 100 were Indian? And I mean, it would just give you a greater perspective of all the experiences that happen in America every day. And, you know, we're so deprived in that way that our culture does not share those stories with us. I mean, you know, I think, there's so much to learn from human experience and we should give it, you know, it's so crazy because when I first went to New York City, I was 18 years old and I was working as an intern in Manhattan and I took the subway to work every day. And I was completely shocked because like a third of the professionals walking on the street were African American. And when you watch shows like Seinfeld and Friends, you have like no idea that New York looks like that. It's all white, you know? And it was just sort of like, wow, no one ever told me. I mean, I just have this, you know, the media doesn't tell you this. And it's sort of sad because we lose so much as a people. I mean, when we don't all, you know, when we don't get to hear everyone's stories.
Well, you kind of mentioned this in one of the pieces you write on your blog about how a lot of people criticize Johnny Depp for playing Tonto, but he meant well. But you would prefer him to use his charisma and his power to tell Native stories, not
yeah.
a
Yeah, I think that's you know, I think that would be way more interesting. You know, I mean, and there are so many amazing Native American writers, and I just there's really no excuse to not. Other than I remember talking to Sherman Alexie, who is a really well-known Spokane Indian writer. He wrote Indian Killer and that collection Tonto and Lone Ranger Fist Fight in Heaven, that short story collection, and he had come out with a film called Smoke Signals, and I had lunch with him shortly after that, and my girlfriend had acted in a film of his, but he was saying that he went to Hollywood and everywhere he pitched a story they were like, hey, great, but let's change the main character to white. You know, everywhere he went, and I hear so many Native American filmmakers say that, and writers, everything is, you know, like, that's a great idea for a story, but let's change the main character to be white. And it's like, that's just how they want the world to look.
And do you
and
th
how.
do you see that n kind of nefariously, or is it just about money that this is a commodity that?
Yeah, I mean that. I mean, I really think that people want to hear all kinds of people's stories. I don't think if they think that it's about money, then they don't really know their audience very well, I would say. I don't think people really care, whether a person is. I don't think that that's enough to put someone off from watching a movie, if it's a good movie.
Smoke Signals was a good movie too. I loved Get Stoic. This is what I remember from when it was at the. 'Cause it was a long time ago too, but the
That
Indians were
was.
supposed to get stoic so that they
Yeah,
looked.
he makes fun of all that kind of stuff. I mean,
Yeah.
Sherman likes, he's really humorous, even in person speaking and stuff. He's just really funny
And in
and
preparation for this, I read that he too celebrates Thanksgiving, but he invites all his brokenhearted and recently divorced white friends over and carries on the tradition.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, I always like hearing what he has to say. I mean, everyone else, I mean, him and I are very different. He grew up on the reservation. He had a serious, when he was born, he had encephalitis, I think. So he was very ill when he was small, and then he what he when he finally went, and his parents were very poor, and alcoholic. And so, and then he later went to off the reservation just so he could finish high school and get a real education. He went to an all-white high school off the reservation and was really an outsider there. So his perspective is very much that perspective of someone who leaves the reservation. And but I really enjoy talking to him, but I think
So we're nearing the end here, but how, so tell us how we're going to be able to get a hold of your new novel. Is that going to be,
well,
are we going to
I have to finally let it go. It's like giving birth, and it's your baby, and you're just clutching on, and I really have to do that process of letting go. It My father passed away this late this summer, and so it was sort of like he's a fictionalized character in a novel, and so it's sort of painful for me to touch it again. He's also a fictionalized character in my second novel, Chalk Rock Colony, which is about a Native American colony. Native American socialist workers colony that was started on my dad's reservation in the 1930s. And I know, American Indian socialists. I didn't know they existed till my grandmother told me. But yeah, I think hopefully soon, as soon as I go through that process. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I know that it sounds fabulous. Most people, they're torn between these two worlds that they inhabit, but you have multiple worlds of different overlapping systems of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I feel very. I mean, one of the things I've been writing a lot about lately, what got me back into writing for op-eds and stuff, was the Baby Veronica case, where a Cherokee girl was being taken from her family, and I just like realized how extraordinarily lucky I was to be raised by my own family in a loving family, and who still had all the stories and still valued the traditions and were able to pass them on. It really helps me. It helps me a lot. And not only the living ones, but the ones who had already passed on and wrote them down. I think all those efforts made by each generation, it really matters. And I can't say as a person of as a Navajo, as a Diné and a Ihonton Dakota, that I would be the same person if I didn't have that input from my family. I don't think I could have done it, and makes so once I it is about Teoshpaya.
Perfect. That was 42 minutes. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to Jacqueline Keeler on SyncBook Radio, production of thesyncbook.com. More information about the work of Mrs. Keeler can be found at Teospeya now. Could you
Teoshpaya.
Teospeya.
Teoshpaya, yeah.
Teospeyanow.blogspot.com. More information about the SyncBook, our guests, or to check out past shows, or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you like what you hear and would like to support the show, please become a donor. Just follow the links on the website to the donation page. Thanks very, very much, truly.
Thanks.
schon ich ohne Hecke ja, als die da beulta. Oh, oh, die da dort ist die Wohnung.